Thank you again. I appreciate you so much for all your support of Air Talk on KPCC. Coming up later this hour, we'll also take a look at a controversial planned expedition to the Titanic on the ocean floor of the Atlantic. We'll talk about why, what the company that's in charge of the wreckage of the Titanic, why it's so controversial, what they're looking to do. But right now, we talk about the Supreme Court nomination process for Judge Amy Coney Barrett. This morning, along party lines, Republicans passed out of the Judiciary Committee that nomination to the full Senate for them to take it up Monday of next week. Joining us to talk about what Democrats did this morning, as well as what the process holds, is SCOTUS blog reporter Amy Howe, who's also author of the blog Howe on the Courts. Amy, good to have you with us again. Paint the scene, if you will, for what that Judiciary Committee vote was like this morning.
It was an unusual scene. Democrats were not there. They decided to boycott the committee hearing, and so in their places, at least for some of the Democratic senators, they had some of the very large posters of constituents who they talked about during the hearings who would be affected, they said, by the invalidation of the Affordable Care Act. And they said, you know, if Judge Barrett were confirmed and became Justice Barrett and voted to strike down the Affordable Care Act.
And that was really the central issue that was raised by Democrats in the hearings last week, right? It was about what happens to the ACA.
That's right. You know, there were 2 days of questioning, and the first day in particular, the Democrats really focused on the Affordable Care Act. They also focused on some other issues like abortion, but the Affordable Care Act, really, there was a central message from Democratic senators at the hearings, and that was definitely it.
All right. And, of course, let's do just a little bit of analysis here. It is not a foregone conclusion that Judge Barrett would vote with a majority of conservative members of the court to overturn the entirety of the ACA, is it?
That's right. I mean, there's a couple different parts. You know, the question before the Supreme Court on November 10th is whether or not the individual mandate, the requirement that all Americans buy health insurance or pay a penalty, is constitutional. And your listeners may recall that back in 2012, the Chief Justice John Roberts joined the court's former liberal justices at the time to hold that it was, whether it's still constitutional now that there's no longer a penalty if you don't get health insurance. And so that's the first question before the court. And then if there are five justices who agree with the challengers in this case, and the challengers are Texas and a group of other states with Republican attorneys general, if they agree that the mandate is now unconstitutional, then the Supreme Court has to decide what happens next. Do they just pluck the mandate out of the Affordable Care Act, or does part or all of the Affordable Care Act go with it? And we don't know Judge Barrett's views on this issue of what happens to the rest of the Affordable Care Act. It's a legal issue called severability. And it was kind of funny, actually, because Lindsey Graham, who's the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, made a point of saying that you know, this case, that the red states and the Trump administration, you know, are arguing that the whole Affordable Care Act should go, actually doesn't have a very good chance of winning. He made a point of saying that at the hearing.
Of course, on the other side, there isn't a Republican alternative, despite President Trump saying that he would be presenting an alternative after he was elected president. That hasn't come. So the ACA is, of course, the program that's there. There isn't anything else that's out there that would fill that gap.
Right. And so Democrats, you know, I think Democrats are saying, you know, there's, even if the chance, we don't know what the chances are that the Supreme Court's going to strike it down, but if the Supreme Court does strike it down, you know, the consequences are enormous.
I believe it's Monday that the full Senate takes this up. What's that process? Is it just an immediate vote, or is there a long debate?
It can depend. You know, the Senate will sort of start to take up the issue on Friday. There's a sort of a discussion about whether or not to limit debate, and then there's the final vote on Monday.
All right. Anything else to add, Amy Hemp, before I let you go?
The vote is likely to be on Monday, and at least with Justice Brett Kavanaugh, he was actually sworn in the same day as his confirmation vote. So, if she is confirmed, and it's looking increasingly like she will be, we could have a Justice Barrett at work on Monday.
Wow. All right. Amy Howe, thank you as always. We appreciate your joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
SCOTUS blog reporter and author of the blog Howe on the Courts. She joins us regularly to talk about the nation's high court. Also with us from Politico, campaign reporter and author of Politico's Morning Score newsletter, Zach Montalero. Zach, good to have you with us again. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me back.
Let's talk about the debate, of course, that is scheduled tonight. The second of the three scheduled debates canceled after President Trump was hospitalized for COVID-19. The third debate, and the final one, Belmont University in Nashville. And it's going to be a bit different during the initial question and answer between moderator and candidate. The other candidate's mic will be turned off. What's the expectation of how that might change the dynamics?
Yeah, so allegedly the first 2 minutes of every segment, then there's six segments, is supposed to have 2 minutes for each candidate to respond uninterrupted to a question. If you even casually watch the first debate, you saw that wasn't the case. The president repeatedly and often interrupted Joe Biden during his first 2 minutes. So now they're cutting the mics for those. So if Joe Biden is speaking during those first 2 minutes, and those first 2 minutes President Trump's mic will be off, and vice versa. When President Trump is speaking, Joe Biden's mic will be off. That rest of the conversation, that remaining 11 minutes, give or take, on each topic, those mics will both be live. And, while I'm sure they'll try to encourage people to stick to their time limits, we saw how effective that was last time, and not at all, but the mics won't be muted for most of the debate.
Well, and what I've been hearing is that, so many of the president's advisors were extremely unhappy with his performance in the first debate, in which he essentially ran roughshod over the process. And is there any word as to whether the president sees, particularly given the polling results afterwards, that he hurt his candidacy?
I mean, listen, the president is who he is, right? Like, Republicans at large have been waiting for Donald Trump to change for the better part of 5 years now, right? And Donald Trump, for better or for worse, is who he is, right? So, I think a lot of Republicans can hope and wish that Donald Trump would come out suddenly a different person who hasn't been president for the last 4 years. But I think the president is probably going to do what he has always done, right? He's going to continue to be the kind of same bellicose president that he has been for his entire presidency. And I can't imagine that changing on the last debate.
Also, my understanding is he's getting advice not to spend a lot of time on Hunter Biden's laptop and emails on the laptop. Frank Luntz, the GOP analyst, pollster, said he thinks that just isn't going to move the needle at all among voters. But that's something that, just from what I'm hearing, inside the White House, that New York Post story about the laptop and the emails, that's sort of energized the president and made him feel like, he can latch on to that.
Yeah, again, for better or for worse, the president believes that he is his own best messenger. In 2016, that was certainly, in his case, for the better, that he ignored what people said he should be talking about, and he ended up winning the presidency, right? In 2020, maybe that's not necessarily the case, that the president is going to focus on what he wants to focus on. He spent the last 3 or 4 days tweeting about a 60 Minutes interview that hasn't even come out yet. And in fact, I think about an hour ago, he just published a White House video of that interview. So the president, we're in the middle of a once-in-a-generation pandemic and a major economic crisis, right? But the president is going to talk about what he wants to talk about. And it seems that what's been on the president's mind as of late has been the vice president's son, has been Joe Biden's son, Hunter Biden.
So you expect we're going to hear a lot about Hunter Biden tonight?
Yeah, maybe I'll be shocked. Maybe the president, after all this time in office, will fundamentally change who he is. But I have a hunch that, the president we've seen in the White House for the last 3.5 years, for better or for worse, and for his supporters, is certainly for the better, right? Because keep in mind that his supporters adore the president. The president will continue to be who he is and ignore the advice that he doesn't deem appropriate from his allies.
Thank you so much, Zach. Always a pleasure to talk with you. Zach Montalero joining us, campaign reporter for Politico, where he's author of Politico's Morning Score newsletter. Reminder, we'll have that debate for you 6 o'clock this evening right here on 89.3 KPCC. It's NPR's live coverage. And of course, that means NPR's outstanding analysis to follow the debate here on KPCC. So good to have you with us on Air Talk, and again, our deep appreciation for your generous support of Air Talk on KPCC. Well, the Los Angeles Unified School District, like districts across the country, are trying to deal with how they're going to reopen on-campus facilities that have been free of students during this time of COVID-19. And at the same time, there is a very high-focus, high-profile pair of Los Angeles school board races that have seen tremendous amount of money come in on both sides. Joining us is KPCC K-12 education reporter Kyle Stokes. Kyle, good morning.
Hello, sir.
So this is against this whole backdrop of schools reeling financially, trying to deal with the pandemic. So what's at stake in these races?
So if the pandemic hasn't illustrated to you just what's at stake with public education, I would urge you to take a look at what's going on in school districts right now. Huge needs of students that are sort of being, you know, that the school board is ultimately responsible for meeting. This is the Los Angeles. This is sort of a governance lesson, but Los Angeles is the largest school district in the country with an independent elected board, which means that not the mayor or any other elected official has control over the school system. The school board is directly elected here by the voters, and that school board has real power to oversee the school district. And so if you are concerned, or if you think that the district is doing the right thing with the policies around, you know, how they're handling distance learning, reopening schools, and, you know, beyond the sort of pandemic related issues, charter school policy, how, you know, equity of funding is handled. There's been a huge debate in recent months about the role of school police in Los Angeles Unified. All of that is riding on the school board election. And of course, I'd be remiss without saying that the school board election is also this sort of it has been and it has continued to be basically a proxy war between teachers unions and charter school interests, who again are sort of going at it, by spending millions of outside dollars. They've picked their candidates, and both are again going at it, and now breaking records with the amount of money that they're spending on the race.
And Kyle, can you explain why this is still such an intense, you know, pitched battle between those two sides when Governor Newsom signed that bill, which makes it more challenging for charter schools to get approval from districts, and that's tightened that whole process? That's what the teachers' unions wanted to see happen. So why is this still such a big issue on a local school board?
Right. That charter school issue, the bill that you're referencing, it was supposed to have been a compromise that was supposed to get the two sides to, you know, kind of bury the hatchet, move on, and focus on the things that they both care about. Charter schools also get public funding, for example, so they're really interested in seeing Prop 15 pass this year, for example, this new school fund, a measure that would fund schools by raising commercial property taxes. And so the idea is, let's move on from all of this. But I think we've seen in Los Angeles Unified that this is not the end of the debate over charter schools. From the charter school perspective, they feel that the district is implementing that new law, because it all really comes back to the school district, how the school district, you know, plays out those regulations at the local level. The charter side would say that the district is not being fair to charter schools in the way that they're playing it out. On the union side, they would say there are still real threats that are posed by charters to district-run schools, because as we say over and over, charter schools are publicly funded, but they're run not by the school district, but by, essentially private entities, by these nonprofit organizations. And when a student leaves an LAUSD school for a charter school, it essentially means that funding leaves the LAUSD, coffers as well. That dynamic still exists. The unions are still concerned about it, and more than just the unions. I mean, you know, there's intense parent activism on both sides of this issue as well. And, you know, that's a real live issue. So the bill you're referencing is a compromise intended to sort of, you know, lower the temperature. I don't know whether it's necessarily succeeded yet. And if you look at the election numbers and spending here, it certainly has not.
I'm really glad you raised the parent part of this, Kyle, because you, I'm sure more than me, but even I have been getting so many messages from parent organizations who are very unhappy with the district. They want to see campuses reopening. They're very critical of the stance that United Teachers Los Angeles, the union, has taken. So where do they fit into this, the candidates, the sort of charter versus union candidates?
Yeah, so I mean, there are certainly groups that you referenced that would like to see a more activist stance taken by the district toward reopening, pushing back a little bit more on the teachers union to reopen the district. On the other hand, I do think there are parents that are also kind of suspicious of the idea of reopening schools, and they might, you know, be, and I think it's when we talk about what how that plays out in the school board race, the candidates themselves, interestingly, when I talk to them, and you can look up, we've got candidate interviews with all four of the candidates in both the Board District 3 and the District 7 race on LAS.com right now. If you go there and read their positions on reopening schools, a lot of them, you know, sort of toe the same lines, or at least similar lines. It seems like there's, you know, not a whole bunch of urgency to get back into, you know, sort of hybrid school mode, super, super fast, at least any faster than what county health guidelines would allow. There's some, you know, candidates who are saying we should have special education students, for example, who are, you know, in really vulnerable situations and you know, may not be able to receive services over distance learning, maybe have them come in. But the candidates themselves are not necessarily right now staking out positions on reopening. That said, some of the parent groups you're referencing, Larry, the groups that are a little bit more focused on reopening schools and see that as more part of their as part of their agenda, they probably line up more with the charter side of things. I think because they see that there's a school board member would need to take a tougher line against the teachers union and try and push the teachers union a little bit harder. So, you know, while the candidates themselves are not necessarily pushing hard on the issue of reopening, I think there is definitely a subset of parents who are lining up to the charter side because they feel like they would drive a harder bargain with the teachers union. I don't know how many parents feel that way, because again, I just want to clearly label that there are probably some parents, you know, many parents who are just as skeptical about the idea of pushing to reopen schools too soon. So
sure,
just
but they would always be, my understanding is even if schools reopen their campuses, there would be an online distance option available, because there are a lot of reasons why some families where there are health vulnerabilities and like would not want to send their kids to school. So is anyone talking about actually mandating with reopening that all the students would have to come back to campus?
I'm unaware of that. Most of the focus that I've had in the last couple of weeks has been on the election. And of course, we did just have an announcement today from the county that they're going to move forward with allowing for a little bit broader reopenings than in the past. But to the specific question you're asking, that you would mandate someone to go back, you know, no, not necessarily.
Yeah, that would seem unlikely just because of the concerns, yeah.
But I would say, I just want to make the point that I think that parent and that public, that opinions about school reopening are complicated. And, I do think there is an intersection with the school board races. I just want to clearly label that it's a complicated issue for a lot of parents.
We're talking with KPECC K-12 education reporter Kyle Stokes. As he just mentioned, you can read his interviews with the four LAUSD candidates at LAS.com, just part of that in-depth coverage of the upcoming elections. District 7, it's Patricia Castellanos and Tanya Ortiz Franklin. And which one is getting the support of charters? Which one's backed by the union?
Yeah, so Patricia Castellanos is the union-backed candidate in this race. She has a history working in the harbor, and also with some different labor-allied activist groups, where she was, for example, a top-ranking person at the LA Alliance for a New Economy, or LANE. They were, you know, famous for the $15 minimum wage resolution. She also co-founded a group called Reclaim Our Schools Los Angeles, which is affiliated with United Teachers Los Angeles, and so has been active in school policy, at least in that regard. And is also a parent of an LAUSD student. She has UTLA support. Tanya Ortiz Franklin doesn't have the support of the California Charter Schools Association, so there is no official endorsement there. But she has gotten the support of some major charter school donors. Bill Bloomfield, to name one, a Manhattan Beach businessman, and Reed Hastings, who's the CEO of Netflix. They've spent a lot of money from the outside on this race, these independent expenditures. They've spent a large sum trying to support her candidacy. So no official charter support there. Okay. And by the way, Tanya Ortiz Franklin works for the Partnership for Law, or I should say is on leave from the Partnership for Los Angeles Schools, okay, which is an organization that runs, manages LAUSD campuses on the district's behalf.
And we should mention District 3, it's incumbent Scott Schmerelson, who's hoping to hold on to his seat against the challenge of Marilyn Kozadiak and funding that's come in from charter school advocates to support her. Kyle, thank you so much. It's Air Talk on KPECC. Exhibitions of what's been found at the site of the Titanic have been huge attractions for many years since the wreckage was discovered. Of course, the Titanic, which sunk in April of 1912 on its maiden voyage, the ship that had been deemed unsinkable, which the lives of more than 1,500 of the estimated 2,200 plus were lost in that tragedy. The wreck wasn't discovered until 1985, and there have been multiple expeditions to the wreckage site to observe it, and sometimes recovering artifacts in the 3.5 decades since. The company, which is essentially the custodial entity over the wreck, the RMS Titanic Incorporated, is planning another expedition, which would attempt to salvage the original Marconi radio, which was used to issue the final distress call, which fortunately did lead to the saving of many lives of those who were able to get into the lifeboats. Joining us to talk about this effort and also about the controversy that it's raised is Breton Hunchak, who's president of RMS Titanic Incorporated. Thank you, Breton, for joining us. We appreciate it. What is the purpose of this effort to salvage the radio? Why do you want to be able to display it?
Sure, absolutely. And thank you so much for having us. We really appreciate the ability to bring public awareness around this issue, because I think the transparency around this expedition has been, you know, much more of our concern than it has been historically. So thanks for the time. Really briefly, and I'll try to keep this as short as I can, because obviously I'm really excited, but the expedition is really about three things, in our opinion. And the first is education. So broadening the scope and reach of what we can bring to students all around the world, keeping the legacy of Titanic alive for the next generation, is really the biggest proponent of what we're doing here. And it's the biggest interest of the company, whether it's our exhibition business, our research, or what RMS Titanic does in communities around the states. So that's sort of the first pillar, if you will. The second, which, you know, doesn't get enough airtime and may not be as exciting in the press, is the research component. So learning about the wreck degradation, which I'll touch on in a bit, and working to draw conclusions of how we can help do our part regarding other maritime disasters. So as you know, getting the Titanic, it's not easy. It's deep. We need a lot of remotely operated vehicles. We need incredible staff. But the information that we can garner from the wreck is important because it talks about when that ship becomes an issue in terms of falling in on itself. And while we're all concerned about that for the Titanic, the conclusions that we can draw for the broader context of the world and other ships that are full of petroleum or hazardous materials and those ticking time bombs around the world, we can get a better of idea okay. of when those need to be addressed. The third piece is really just celebrating the legacy of the passengers. And in this instance, we are going to do that by respectfully retrieving what's been called the voice of the Titanic, the Marconi Wireless. So I think it's such an interesting story, and you know, I'll give a little bit on it, but people can read into it. But these two gentlemen really surpassed all expectations and broke the rules a bit in order to save so many souls that evening. And I think their legacy and the legacy of descendants of survivors really is better suited and told in a public forum. And our ability to bring up the Marconi, I think, is going to invite so many people to share those stories and keep them alive for generations to come.
So your thought is a replica doesn't do the same thing. People are going to be so attracted to see the actual Marconi radio that you'll have a chance to tell that story more broadly.
Sure, I think so. And the proof is really in the fact that over the past two decades, over 30 million people have come to Titanic exhibitions. And, you know, our view is that prior to that, you needed a submarine and you needed a lot of money just to get your one-on-one experience with these artifacts. And, you know, to be honest, I'm stealing some of this from Dr. David Gallo, but that intimate experience with the artifacts and the way we see children and older folks and, you know, adults in our exhibitions experiencing Titanic the way Jim Cameron gets to, or the way that, you know, David Gallo or Dave Kincannon or Rory Golden, all these guys get to see it, we're providing that to the rest of the world. And I really feel like that's breaking down okay. some of the elitism behind what is deep sea research.
President of RMS Titanic Incorporated, Breton Hunchak, with us. This is the organization serving as the steward of the Titanic wreck site and the company which owns the salvage rights to the Titanic. Also with us, the curator of maritime history at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History, where he's also the acting chair of the Division of Work and Industry, Paul Johnston. Mr. Johnston is also an underwater archaeologist and has himself explored a number of shipwrecks. Thank you so much, sir, for being with us. What are your concerns about this salvage mission to bring up the Marconi radio?
Well, I think I have several concerns. Probably first concern is that RMST is proposing to destroy original fabric of the shipwreck to get to portions of the Marconi. They're not really bringing up the transmitting gear, they're bringing up power equipment that's related to the transmitting gear, and it's not really the voice of the Titanic. I think that's an exaggeration. It was a Morse code device at its very best, and there's very little of it left. It's really not restorable, so I think it's pretty much hyperbole to consider that it's the voice of the Titanic. We're also talking about violating or desecrating a gravesite for 1,500 people. And I think RMST would like to bury this under an unlikely scenario. But let me just point out two very famous shipwrecks that have yielded human remains, and that would be the Ironclad Monitor and the famous Hunley, the Confederate submarine, both of which sank in the Civil War, which are a whole lot older than Titanic, but yielded human remains that have actually given us quite a bit of information through DNA analysis. So I think there's an awful lot of hyperbole involved in the program about calling this the voice of the Titanic. Also, it's not unique technology. There are several examples of that very Marconi technology in museums all over the world, really.
Is there... I was just going to ask, is there any way that critics would be able to stop this mission aside from building public support against it? Are there legal grounds to take action against RMS Titanic?
Well, I think the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, acting on behalf of the government of the United States, has lodged a, I wouldn't call it a restraining order, but they've launched an appeal to the permission granted by the U.S. District Court in Norfolk, Virginia, claiming that they have some oversight. And if they do have that oversight, then they can at least help guide the expedition to a little bit more scientific and research-oriented path. Right now, we don't know anything about the plans for how they plan to break through the original fabric. They have not shared that. They haven't shared their funding plan for conservation of the artifacts or pretty much anything. They've said, well, just trust us. We've been down there a few times before, so we'll just sort of figure it out on the way as we go along. And that's not really kind of a scientific expedition.
We're almost out of time, but Breton Hunchak, can you just real quickly share with us what the plan is, how you would cut through and get to where the radio is?
Funny enough, I actually think we shared the extraction plan with you all at NPR, and we've shared this publicly. And our goal actually is not to cut anything. The interesting point that Mr. Johnson makes is we're looking for a shiny new artifact, which I think downplays a bit of what the Marconi is, but also is ignorant the fact that his background is working with the Smithsonian to exhibit artifacts from shipwrecks that have had human remains. If you want some reading to look into the Monitor project, the Monitor was not at this depth. So when you look at the pH component and the mud causticity, the likelihood of human remains is very low. In addition, we have hundreds of hours of firsthand footage, including that of Expedition Heroes, including Rory Golden and James Cameron, citing never seeing human remains at the site. So we find pause with a lot of these comments,
okay,
and we find the basis of them is in projects that these people have worked on that were a little in their standards.
Gentlemen, thank you for being with us and giving us, albeit a brief, overview of what's at stake here. Breton Hunchak, president of RMS Titanic, Inc., and Paul Johnston of the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I appreciate you so much. And now I need to hear from you with your account of the small business that you've financially supported, whether it's a GoFundMe or you've done something above and beyond just patronizing the business. I know when we were talking about this among our Air Talk producers, I think everyone that was in our morning meeting had supported at least one small business, whether it was a music club. In my case, there are a couple of different music venues that have been closed now for 7 months that I don't want to see go away. And so I financially supported those clubs to try and do just a little bit to try and help them get through this period. I'd like to hear from you what you're doing, whether it's a small business of any kind, whether it's a bookstore, a music store, whether it's a club, a music venue of any kind, whether it's a restaurant, a bar. What are the things you've done to try and financially support and give a quick shout out? I want to go rapid fire and get as many Southern California small businesses the credit here. And if you operate a small business and you've set up a GoFundMe, I would, or something equivalent, I would like to hear from you and just give us a quick response and what that feels like to have people supporting a for-profit business with a non-tax-deductible contribution like that. I just want to also caution, please do not make any appeal for money on our air because we cannot do that as a nonprofit. But I want to hear from you what the response is. 866-888-5722. KPCC.org. It is absolutely critical. I hear from you now about what you're doing to financially support small businesses that are closed because of the pandemic or that are on the ropes right now. 866-893-KPECC. EGW, our AirTalk listener, puts on the AirTalk page at kpcc.org a CNN story about how Black businesses have disproportionately been affected by all the lockdowns and the pandemic. EGW quoting that 50% of African-American small businesses have closed as a result of what's happened during the pandemic. A third of Latino-owned and operated businesses. It's just been a huge effect. 866-888-5722, kpecc.org. I look forward to hearing what you're doing to support businesses. I supported Catalina Jazz Club in Hollywood. They have a GoFundMe because, you know, I know that these kinds of music clubs that are few and far between, it's going to be very difficult for them to be able to stick around and be able to deal with their leases and get employees back and all when they are able to reopen. Teresa, in Studio City, what is the business you're supporting?
Book Soup. In West Hollywood, actually, it's an independent bookstore. No matter what the occasion, everybody's getting a book from me this year as a gift.
Oh, that's terrific. And Vroman's, of course, in Pasadena, also operating Book Soup. And Vroman's, my understanding is, since they put out the word that they were financially threatened as a result of the pandemic, they have had huge groups coming down, people having to wait on the sidewalk because of, you know, COVID-19 limits so that they could come in and buy their books. And Teresa, that's wonderful, because if we don't have our brick and mortar bookstores, if they're not available for us to be able to go in and have that sort of, you know, discovery of something that we'd never even thought to get, or the hand selling that goes on with the people that work at bookstores who are so invested in the written word and read so widely and can answer your questions and give you recommendations. I can't imagine what that would be like. 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. Matt, our producer, said when his gym CrossFit North Pasadena closed down at the start of the pandemic, he thought he'd suspend his membership and try to save that money. But he decided to keep his membership active because he wanted the gym to be there when things opened back up. The owners, Gabe and Karina Perez, have done so much, Matt says, for him to help his health and fitness. The irony is the gym is still closing down for good this week. But Matt says he can still sleep knowing he did his part. Matt, that's wonderful. And I think that speaks to exactly the kind of thing that we're talking about here, where you believe in the business, not just as the sustenance for a family that relies on it, but for what it's provided you, and you want to keep it going. 866-893-5722. You can tweet at Air Talk. You can post on the Air Talk Facebook page. If you have a business that has been badly hurt or at least temporarily closed or is on the ropes financially because of the pandemic, and you've set up some way for your customers to support you, then let us know about that effort and what kind of response you've received. 866-893-5722. Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Bill in the San Gabriel Valley says, Culture Club 101, a market for fermented food, handmade almond butter, flavored almonds, kraut juice, other healthy foods. Before the shutdown, there was a cafe where we had lunch every Saturday at Washington and Hill, same block as the Domino's Pizza. Also, Roma Market, the Italian grocery store at Lake and Mountain, and Vroman's, of course, which I mentioned, Southern California's institution, historically significant Vroman's, the largest independent bookstore around. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. What are the businesses, for-profit businesses, that you are making a commitment to support during this time of tremendous financial stress? I know that for restaurants, for example, you know, some of them are just hanging on and have set up ways for their customers to help tide them over. Maybe it's selling gift cards, so at least they have the money from the gift card that they can bank in advance to be able to handle so many of the expenses that are ongoing. 866-893-KPECC, the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. You can post on the Air Talk Facebook page, and you can tweet at AirTalk. I was based on the fact that all of our producers had done something to support a local business financially. My assumption was that there are a lot of AirTalk listeners that are doing something similarly. If you have the means, maybe it's even a small contribution. Maybe it's just a few bucks, but symbolically, at the very least, you are showing this business that you care about it. All right. Also, just want to let you know that coming up a little bit later this hour, we're going to be talking with the Libertarian Party candidate for president, Joe Jorgensen, who was a lecturer at Clemson University. And we're going to talk with her about her candidacy. It's part of our ongoing series, third-party presidential candidates who are on the California ballot. And we've had so far the Peace and Freedom Party candidate and the Green Party candidate. Today it's the Libertarian Party candidate, Joe Jorgensen, who joins us later this hour. Judith, in Beverly Hills, which business are you supporting and how?
I am supporting Diesel, an independent bookstore in Santa Monica, buying lots of books.
Great.
Fountain Theater on Fountain in Hollywood, making contributions to them and donations and attending their live performances virtually.
All right. Very good. And also there's a restaurant, I understand, a small restaurant you're supporting?
Yes. Prospect Gourmando on Robertson in Beverly Hills. It's a husband and wife, and it's a wonderful little place, and I hope they make it.
All right. We do, too. Judah, thank you so much. 866-893-KPCC. If you own or manage a small business where you've gone directly to your customers or friends for support, what kind of support have you received? 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Sandra tweets at AirTalk, I support local South Bay bands who have no place to play. They live stream and I donate what I would be paying for drinks at a bar. John on the AirTalk Facebook page joins me with Catalina Jazz Club in Hollywood, supporting them, Easton's Gym, and three independent music artists. That's John on the AirTalk Facebook page. Alex in Venice Beach. Alex, what are you supporting?
It's a little old movie theater in El Segundo. It's called the Old Town Music Hall.
Yeah, you're cutting it. I'm sorry. The Old Town Music Hall. Yeah, in El Segundo with that organ. I know they put on shows regularly. That's terrific. So glad to hear about that, Alex. What business are you supporting with whatever you can do to help them financially during this challenging time? 866-893-5722. It's Air Talk. So good to have you with us today on Air Talk. I can't thank you enough for your generous support of the program. In just a few minutes, we'll talk with the Libertarian Party candidate for president, Joe Jorgensen. The Libertarian Party received the third highest number of votes in the 2016 presidential election. We'll talk with Joe Jorgensen about her candidacy, this part of our continuing series of talking with the presidential candidates from so-called third parties on your California ballot beyond a the two representatives of the major parties. But right now, I'm asking for you to call to talk about businesses that you are supporting financially to help them through this very challenging time of the pandemic. We have Yvette in San Gabriel. Yvette, what business are you supporting?
It's a small privately owned boot camp in the area where I live. And when we first went on lockdown, I let him keep charging. I had it on auto pay. So for about 3 months, I didn't go because he wasn't open, but I kept letting him charge me. And then once everything opened up, because of where I work, I'm not comfortable going back to a
To the boot camp.
Situation like that. I don't want to expose other people. And he, even though it's outside now, where the center where he is, they've allowed him to move his equipment outside. I still don't want to go back.
Sure. Have you kept up with your monthly membership?
It's on auto pay. So
yes,
what I did about, after about 3 months, I went when they were going to allow gyms to open back up. I went back and told them, you know, I can't keep paying you the full amount, but I want you to stay in business so that when I am ready to come back, you'll still be here. So I said, what if I let you keep charging me half? And then when I am ready to come, you let me come back.
So you're doing that. Yvette, thank you so much. 866-893-KPECC. Let's see. We've got listener Alisa in Simi Valley. Eastside Eats, a catering company in Boyle Heights that she is supporting. Also, the Doggy Daycare in Pasadena. I dig my dog. Oh, such nice folks there. Allison in Topanga says, I'm supporting Lenore's Vegetarian Restaurant in West Hollywood and also my gym, the Calabasas Swim and Tennis Center. We're talking about for-profit businesses that you're doing what you can to try and help them through this extraordinarily challenging time. Jessica in Santa Monica, you are a business owner. What's your business and what financial support are you receiving?
Yes, I have a catering business. And so we've continued to do some family meals during this time since everyone's been at home. And I have two preschools that we also make individualized lunches for. So I opened that up for my clients to add donations when they're purchasing a meal so that we could do the meals support for those who need, you know, food right now. So we partnered with I'm a volunteer at the American Red Cross and Team Rubicon, who have helped with delivering food, food services for those in need.
This is wonderful, Jessica. Thanks, and glad that you're receiving that support. Kim writes on the AirTalk page, we frequently order from Il Forno Restaurant in Santa Monica. The owners and staff are wonderful, and this little restaurant's a lovely member of the community. They know their patrons and contribute to fundraisers. I really want them to stick around. Also, Children's Book World in West Los Angeles, gift cards and purchases. We patronize places that mean something to us, and we try to buy local when possible, but these are standouts off the top of my head. Kim, thank you so much for that. And I think that's a terrific way to just share the thought that goes behind this. We know, of course, there's so many charitable organizations that you support, but this talking about for-profit businesses, you're trying to help tide them over during this incredibly challenging time. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Just want to remind you that we have an incredible store of voter information on our specially designated website, votergameplan.com. You'll find there the voter cram session that I did with our four expert guests. In less than an hour, all 12 of California's ballot propositions, you hear the pros and cons, plus all the in-depth debates that we did on all 12 of the ballot propositions here on Air Talk. They are archived, available for your listening, so you feel that you can be the best informed when you cast your ballot here in California. It's votergameplan.com. And as part of our continuing coverage of the election, we also have a series of the third-party presidential candidates. We've heard from the Green, from the Peace and Freedom, and today it's the Libertarian Party presidential candidate, Joe Jorgensen. Thank you so much for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Oh, so glad to be here. Thanks so much.
So last time around, 2016, we saw that the Libertarian Party candidate, Gary Johnson, former governor of New Mexico, actually got more than 3% of the vote, a historic high for a Libertarian Party candidate. This time around, you don't necessarily have the name recognition or being a former governor. What are you hoping will be the impact of your candidacy?
Well, I hope to at least beat his 2012 numbers, and it would be nice to beat those. But let me point out, part of the name recognition problem isn't the fact that I'm a former governor. In fact, if you ask the average person on the street, do you know who a former governor of Utah was? Or do you know what the former governor of Arizona was? I mean, most people just aren't, you know, aren't keeping up with it that closely. The problem was, in order to get into the debates, you need to poll at 15%. And Gary Johnson was included in all the polls, and he got as high as 13.6%. And we think that the powers that be were like, okay, 13.6, that's dangerously close to 15%. So what do they do this year? They don't even include my name in the polls. So if your name is in the polls, then it's reported on TV, newspapers, internet, and people see that there's another person running. Right now, it's hard to get the message out that there's even an alternative to the two people who are running.
Let's talk briefly about your background. You have been a full-time lecturer at Clemson University in South Carolina. What's your field of expertise?
My PhD is in industrial organizational psychology. I also have an MBA, and I teach intro to the large lecture halls at Clemson.
And what led you to become a libertarian? What about its policies appealed to you?
Well, first of all, I was a libertarian and just didn't know it until I heard about the party. I read Animal Farm as a when I was in grade school, and I realized that, yeah, that's just not fair to have a few elite making rules for everybody else, and that as soon as we elect people into power, then they start getting corrupted too. So I really didn't like the idea of the elite being in power. And as soon when I was finishing up my schooling, my MBA, I heard a libertarian on the radio, and I thought, wow, I didn't know anybody else agreed with me. So I immediately joined the movement.
If you have questions for Joe Jorgensen, Libertarian Party candidate for president, you can post them on the AirTalk page at kpecc.org. You can also call 866-893-5722, and I will pass on select questions to Joe Jorgensen. So let's talk about the party platform. I actually watched on YouTube a little bit of the virtual convention, and it was interesting because a number of people made motions that tax taxation is theft. Explain that view that the party has of taxation.
Well, I was hoping to come on and talk about my platform, which I've not been trying to spread that message because people really haven't been interested in the theoretical or the philosophical. What I've been going around doing is trying to explain that, you know, there's a myth out there that we have a free market system in our healthcare, and that's why our healthcare isn't working. And I'm here to say that we haven't had a free market in healthcare for almost 100 years. That's why our healthcare isn't working. I'm also here to say that I want to bring our troops home and turn America into one giant Switzerland. We absolutely have to protect our shores. However, there's no reason for us to be in 150 different countries around the world. And also, we spend more than the next seven countries combined in military. And there's no need for that, especially if we're protecting our shores. And also, I'm concerned about the environment. And especially since there, some of the other parties are talking about things that would make the environment worse. And speaking of third parties, I was in a third party debate in Chicago in March, and a woman running for the Socialist Party in her closing remarks said, you know, the Department of Defense is the largest polluter on earth. And then her next sentence was talking about how bad corporations were for the environment. And I just thought to myself, did you hear what you just said? You know, if the United States Department of Defense is the worst polluter on earth, then why are you going to the United States government to fix the problem? You usually don't go to the people who are causing the problem to fix it.
We're talking with Joe Jorgensen, Libertarian Party candidate for president. If you have questions for her, you can post them on the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. And by the way, the Socialist Party candidate that was just mentioned was our guest with us yesterday on AirTalk, and you can hear that interview if you missed any of the third-party candidate interviews. That's Gloria LaRiva, who is running in California. It's the Peace and Freedom Party under their banner. We'll continue with Joe Jorgensen. We'll get back to the issue of taxation and what her platform is on that, as well as some of the other issues to raise. It's Air Talk on KPCC. Over the past couple of days on Air Talk, as we've been into our series on third-party candidates on the California ballot, we've heard From Howie Hawkins, the Green Party presidential candidate, Gloria LaRiva, whose socialist party is running as Peace and Freedom here in California. And in both cases, their view is that there needs to be a lot more contributed by taxpayers. With us from the Libertarian Party presidential candidate, Joe Jorgensen, senior lecturer at Clemson University in South Carolina. Joe Jorgensen, what is your view of the proper level of taxation? How would you establish the tax system if you were elected president?
Well, my goal is to reduce the income tax to zero, which would give every family about $12,000 extra per year on average, because I've been going around telling voters that you know better how to spend your money than any politician or special interest in Washington. And by the way, I'm sure you can make better decisions for your family because you know what your family needs, not the people in Washington.
What would, without a progressive income tax, what would be the effect on income inequality in America?
Well, I would suggest right now we've got income inequality in part because we have a big government. You know, people point to corporations as having a lot of power. Yeah, why do they have that power? They get it from Congress. They get it from the special interests. What happens is, in order to get elected, you have to cater to the companies. And, you know, in many cases, these corporations are the ones actually writing the bills. And so they write the bills, and many of these bills have been written just for one company. If you look to see what the requirements are for whatever bill, you'll see that there's only one company in the entire country that it would apply to. And that's what I want to get rid of. You and I can better determine which companies are working for us. You and I can better determine which companies we think deserve our business rather than the politicians in Washington getting money and then telling us which companies are worthy. And then you've got something like, you know, we saw with the coronavirus shutdown. Notice the people in Congress and people at the state level, at the urging of the national level from the president, notice how big box stores and large chains were able to stay open. And it's the little mom and pop stores who suffered, who were forced to close and not earn any money. So why do we need people telling us that we have to only buy from the big corporations and not the little mom and pop stores?
We're talking with Joe Jorgensen, Libertarian Party candidate for president. You were talking earlier about the current government-backed healthcare program not really being a full free market. So what would you rather see, and what would the implications be on Medicare and Medicaid programs?
Well, it's not even a half of a free market. And if you look towards Singapore, their costs are one-third of ours, and they're closer to a free market. If you look at in our system, the closest we have to a free market would be cosmetic surgery and LASIK surgery. And the reason it's somewhat free market is because people pay their own dollars instead of the insurance companies. And so they shop around for the best prices, and healthcare providers are required to offer it if they get any business. And over a 20-year period recently, what we saw was LASIK surgery prices. Well, first of all, starting with the old technology, and notice how much the technology improved with competition, the prices went down something like 70%, while general health care went up 125%. And last, the biggest problem is that our insurance isn't really insurance. If car insurance paid for gas, oil, car washes, first of all, you would have absolutely no reason to shop around for the best gas prices. In fact, you might even go to the most expensive station where they offer you free coffee, because what do you care? You've got your little $5 copay. Costs as much to go to the expensive one as the cheap one. Therefore, gas stations could pass along the higher prices to the car insurance companies, and in return, the car insurance companies would increase your premiums the following year. And you'd get this spiral going that we have in healthcare. There's absolutely nobody holding prices down. And it's a myth to say that insurance companies are trying to hold prices down, because, of course, they can't accept all claims. They've got to deny some. They don't have bottomless pockets. But it's in the insurance company's best interest to allow more claims this year than last year, so that they can make more profits and charge more premiums the following year. There's absolutely nobody holding down prices.
Joe Jorgensen, Libertarian Party candidate for president. You're talking, though, about elective procedures that typically people of some means are going to do. So much of the healthcare system, of course, is not elective. It's supplying life and death care for people who may well not be able to afford it, even under fully competitive free market kinds of prices that you say would be lower. So what would provide for those individuals needing care?
Well, first of all, I would suggest that if knee surgery or heart bypass, if those were under the free market, that those prices would have come down too. Just like we had 70% price decrease, I would suggest it's the poor people who are more hurt by the prices going up 125% because there's no accountability. But I'd like to point out that in Singapore, a doctor visit costs $10, which is less than our copay here because they've got competition. And last, what I would do personally, because we can't just get to the free market overnight because government has already inflated the cost so much. What I would do is have a system like the state of Indiana. I would actually put healthcare dollars into the hands of people with Medicare, Medicaid, and veterans, and then give them real insurance, put dollars in their pocket so they can go out and they can shop around for the best prices. And what they saw in Indiana, the number of people using generic drugs went from something like 10% up to 90%. And the best part is they were happy to do it because they got to keep the savings, and they should. We should reward people for going around. And, you know, that's what you do when you buy groceries. You buy a car, you buy a computer. You get to keep the savings.
Joe Jorgensen, Libertarian Party candidate for president. What criminal justice reforms are you advocating?
Oh, everywhere. First of all, we need to get rid of no-knock raids, qualified immunity, get rid of the racist and destructive war on drugs. And I want to see prisons taken out of the hands of outside companies, for-profit companies. That's one of the few functions that government should do, is running prisons. And we should not put it in the hands of people who make more money if we have more prisoners.
And that's not contradictory to the free market view of the Libertarian Party?
Libertarians, at least my platform and most libertarians, will tell you that the proper function of government is police, courts, and military. So this is absolutely what the government should be doing. And that's the ironic thing here, is government's not doing what they should be doing, which is housing prisoners. And instead, they're turning it into a for-profit system. And then they're doing things they shouldn't, such as we've got the federal government telling every locality in the country how they should run their schools and telling us what kind of retirement we should have. How about having government do what they should be doing?
And you advocate for legalizing all recreational drugs. Is that correct?
I would decriminalize all drugs at the federal level.
All right. And sex work also, is that something you would decriminalize, all sex work?
Yes. I mean, if you look at sex work, it's a combination of sex and the free market, capitalism. You know, which are you against? And I'd like to point out that that would be discriminatory against people who couldn't get dates because of any other means.
All right. Thank you very much. We appreciate it. Joe Jorgensen, one of the third party presidential candidates, joining us in this series. Libertarian Party candidate for president, Joe Jorgensen, who is senior lecturer at Clemson University in South Carolina. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Do want to remind you, tomorrow at 11, it's Film Week, and we've got a particularly chock full of interesting film week, including Spike Lee's new musical documentary on David Byrne and his Broadway show. But that's just one of many really interesting films.